Greetings and salutations to our fine podcast audience. Welcome to Three Peas in a Pod, episode 279.
We made it.
Yes, we're here. And I always feel like we're making it back because this is one of those situations where this is a new taping segment.
It is.
We take these three or four at a time, sometimes two or three at a time.
Yep.
And here we are. This is number one. So we're fresh on this one.
We are.
The next couple of weeks, who knows what you're going to get?
That's true. Who knows what you're going to get on this one?
Well, that's better. We could have warmed up.
Well, maybe.
That's true. Maybe we're not fresh. Maybe we're starting cold.
That's for old people.
Okay, true.
We need warming up. So today we have a question. It's a lot of question. I think there's a lot of stuff in this question.
Oh, that's a good one. Get as much as you can in the question.
Maybe we should have made this into several episodes.
We'll see. Helped us. All right. So here's the question. Are you ready?
Yep.
I'm ready.
You're ready. Is the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve eating the forbidden fruit literal? If it is literal, why would God set them up to sin? Why would he curse all future generations because of their choice? But if the story isn't literal, does that mean there was no original sin and we're all not born sinners?
Mm.
A lot of assumptions in there to me.
Well, yeah, and a lot of little questions. Maybe we just need to take them one by one.
Let's list out the assumptions. So, So there's an assumption that people are born sinners.
What I think they're trying to get at is how does that work? That kind of thing.
That means before they do anything, they're already in sin. That's the assumption of what original sin is.
And okay. There are some Christians that buy into that.
And I think that's the key is that, and maybe the questioner doesn't know that, not all Christians believe that.
That's correct. True.
Yeah. Correct.
And so you want to take them one at a time?
Yeah, I'd say just go in order, and then we can address assumptions.
I always like to go backwards.
You do. Is that what it is? What you like to do is you can only remember the last question someone asked.
I like to go backwards because I feel like almost always the last question was the real question.
I don't know on this.
All right, so the very first question, going in the chronological order.
Okay.
Oh, they want to know is the story of Adam and Eve, the garden, the forbidden fruit. Is that a literal story? And I guess by literal, what you mean is that exactly how it happened?
Two
naked people in a garden with a snake that might have had legs but didn't, and all that.
It had legs, Jason.
You're assuming a lot.
Oh, okay. I guess that's right.
We are told later it's going to crawl on its belly,
which means it wasn't before,
but it could
have
been floating.
It was a flying snake.
Flying snake.
I hadn't thought about that.
Let's get to that.
I like that it would be a flying, because that would be really, really scary.
Well, maybe we should
stop. I don't like snakes anyway.
Maybe this will help us get to the thing.
All right. So that's the first question. Is it all literal?
So here's what I would say. I do not believe you have to take everything that is written in that as a blow-by-blow, literally something. Someone was sitting there and they jotted it down as it went.
We wish we knew that person's name.
No. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Who would that person be?
Have to be Adam and Eve or God.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Or even that they passed it down and this is exactly how the thing happened or whatever. Mm-hmm. Can you believe that? Absolutely. I think you can believe that. There is nothing in the text that one way or the other says this is absolutely literal. This is a metaphor of a truth that is something that happened, but this is the kind of, and I hate to use this word because this word sounds fake, like the mythological way that it happened. Mm-hmm. I don't mean myth as if it isn't real, but I mean as in the way that scholars use the word myth, which is it is a story that represents something. Mm-hmm. It represents a real thing that happened, but using images and poetry and things like this to describe a deeper truth to something that happened. So my answer to is the story, my answer is I don't know.
That's true. None of us do.
I don't know whether this is literally blow by blow the way it happened.
And to be fair, a lot of people who would say, I'm not convinced that it was a literal retelling of an actual event like that, point to the fact that this story, if you know your history, is is borrowing from a lot of creation stories that were circulating within the time.
That's right.
And a lot of people have trouble with that. They think that makes it not valid. But the truth is, the Bible was written as a response to a lot of the stuff that was floating around in the culture.
That's
to
right.
say, you know, you kind of like the way Jesus taught it. You heard it said this way, but let me show you a better way.
That's right.
And a lot of this creation story is written in that style of they borrow from the myths of the day and they reform it within the context of Yahweh, the one true God, interacting with human beings. And so a lot of people would look at that and say, no, this is an author's way of helping us understand who God is and how the world works. So in that vein, a lot of people would say, you know, you don't have to take it blow by blow.
Well, and that's what I would say. I would say you don't have to.
Yeah.
I would say that you can.
Sure.
And that I don't think that those of us who say it is literal, those of us who would say, no, I think it's more of a metaphorical kind of story about the way that humanity has interacted with God. I don't know that either one of us have to come to different conclusions about the most important truths of who Jesus is and what those stories are trying to say to us. Because regardless of whether you think it's a literal story in that blow by blow, this is how it happened, or a metaphorical story, I think what most scholars agree to is that Genesis 1 through 3 and even Genesis 1 through 11 are what you would call typological stories, which means they are setting up themes and ideas and types that will carry on throughout the story. Because it's in Romans, I believe, Paul picks this up and talks about if one man, Adam, did this, and he's not specifically saying this one exact, here's his social security number, so you know this one unique. He's saying if this type of man, Adam, this one type, there, Christ is another type of that man to make things right. And so that's how I would say it is, regardless of whether it's literal and whether... And that maybe gets to the second question of future generations being cursed because of a literal one man or because of this typological one man. Either way, this stand-in for humanity. I don't know that the results of that and even the questions you have that follow are altered either way.
Well, and to be fair, if you want to take it literal, that's fine, but you got some hurdles to get over. You really do got to figure some of this stuff out, because we've said this before. If you read through those first three chapters, especially the first two, there's two accounts of how the world was made. There's two creation accounts. People don't realize that.
That's right.
I'm talking about specifically Genesis 1 and Genesis 2.
They go through the creation story, and then it kind of starts over, and it does another retelling, and some of the details don't line up.
Yeah, they're a little out of order.
They're a little out of order. So you do have to do some justifying in that. So everybody's got to figure all that out.
And then you get hung up on who these boys marrying when they go out.
Yeah,
where'd all those people come from?
If there's just two people and then there's four.
And then there's other places.
Cities somewhere. There's some stuff that happened that aren't in the book necessarily.
Yeah, if that is in case.
That's the way it is. Yeah. Okay. Well, that leads to the next question,
what I wanted to say about all of that is I think almost all of those kind of things, if you just read the Bible as a story, and let's say I don't even know what Paul has said about Adam somewhere in the future. I don't know any of that. The Bible is God communicating to us. People often think, and I'm not saying it's totally wrong, if this is a record of people's interacting with God. That's not the way I understand the Bible. It is God's interacting with humanity. It is people recording the way they understood God interacting with humanity. This account as well is telling us stuff about God. I think Genesis 1 creation account is, again, telling them that God is greater than all these other things that the other gods supposedly were over. He's over the sun because he made it. He's over the stars because he made it. He's over the moon because he made it. He's over the fish. He's over... You're learning about who God is, and you get down to, is God like the other gods we hear about that plays with human beings and he uses them for his own benefit? No, this God that you're learning about creates a beautiful place for people to live where it's And he gives them back and forth kind of relationship where he's walking and talking about them. To me, that kind of beginning, if you just get that story, you get a lot about God that can correct a lot of stuff that people have later of God's this angry God and he, you know, and he's cursing people and the curse sounds like, but what God's describing is a natural consequence of what happened in this kind of thing. It's not like he's proscriptively making stuff happen.
Right.
He's describing what's going to happen that you don't know. When you chose this, I tried to tell you not to choose it. When you chose it, this is what's going to happen.
So that gets to, glad you mentioned that, Ed, because that gets to the next set of questions, and they kind of go together. The questioner says, so if it is a literal story, why would God set people up to sin, and why would he curse future generations because of their sin? And you just are addressing that. This is not necessarily a direct, like you said, curse. God's going to get you for that kind of thing. It's a, here's how the world works. He gives us free will to choose.
Yeah.
And then our choices create consequences.
Even that little phrase, and I'm not saying the questioner, because this is a way people post it.
It does.
And I'm not saying that I haven't posted in my mind. The more I have come to know about the God that Jesus tells us about, that the Bible describes, that idea that God set us up, well, it means, what they mean is, why do you give us free will?
Yeah.
Well, the fact that you can ask that question is because you have free will. And he did that because you can't choose to love something if you can't choose.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And so God did make a being because he wanted Father, Son, and Spirit are a community of love who wanted to expand the community of love. We are created in love to love and to be loved.
Yes.
And so the only way to love and be loved is to choose.
Yes.
So he had to give us choice. The only way to have a choice is to have something that I'm telling you, I love you. Don't do that.
So what you're saying, Ed, is Sting was right. If you love someone, set them free.
Well, okay.
There you go. Yeah.
Do you know that reference?
I do.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean everyone else does.
That doesn't, but I knew it.
As a former bass player, I've always loved Sting.
Sting's great.
That's awesome.
So,
yeah.
I think in regards to this, maybe this helps too with even the previous part of this question. I think, so my understanding, once again, regardless of, and this I think is hard for some people, I don't really think too much of whether it's literal or not. I'm very open-ended on that. It is perfectly okay for me to read the scripture and go, okay, this could be a literal account that happened, or it could be just typological. There were people, because the way I now understand the book of Genesis and really almost everything leading up is, Ed's point's really good, is this is not about people interacting with God. It's about God revealing himself. But even more specifically, these are not, Genesis was not written, we say this all the time, it's not written to me. It is good that it's for me, but this was written to the people of Israel. So this is about how God reveals himself to Israel. And the book of Genesis, even the creation account, what is very clear is all the themes that are set up is not even about, this is what all humanity does. Mm-hmm. It really is about, this is what Israel does. Mm-hmm. He is, because over and over again, they keep linking Abraham to Adam, and then Moses and all of them to Abraham. It is all of these people because, as you said, the way cultural myths at the time, but not very different than in ours, where we like to think George Washington never could tell a lie. And, you know, he chopped down the cherry tree.
Everyone came to America for religious freedom. It didn't have anything to do with making money.
Right, exactly. So we have all of these... We want to say our ancestors. So that's,
that's a foundational myth
that's
of
a
our
myth.
Country.
Yes. It is a myth.
And even the idea of everyone keeps pointing back to, well, the founding fathers would have wanted, and we have these ideas of the people who were our ancestors. They were good people. They were honest people. And what the scriptures do frequently is go, the only one who's good is God.
That's right.
And everyone, even your best people, Abraham, who's one of the best people we could have had, still kept messing it up and kept blowing it up. And all of those, when you read the Abraham stories where he sins and fails, it uses a lot of the same language of, and he saw it was good and pleasing, which is the same language of Eve and Adam seeing the fruit and seeing it is what they're trying to tie into all of this is what is frequently happening to people as they interact with God. But the issue is not, and I think this is the way we see it to go to the set them up to sin, is we tend to see it as God made a good and pleasing world. And then to test us, he came up with this really good and pleasing thing. You know, whatever it is. I mean, it's like teenage boys in youth group who are like, oh, you know, sex is the best thing, but God made it so good and now I can't have it until I get married and blah, blah, blah. That's not the way sin works. Is God did not set it up as something that is good and pleasing to the eye. It is not until the serpent comes to them and speaks to them that they look at the fruit and they go, oh, that is good and pleasing to the eye.
I wonder if God's holding out.
Well, yeah, I think that's actually the original temptation is you can't really trust him.
Right.
You can't trust him. I know you haven't been over there and you haven't looked at it because he told you not to. But if you went over there, you'd see it's better than anything else you have. Mm-hmm. And you can't trust him. He's withholding the good stuff from you.
It's the deception of the serpent. And you see that played out all throughout the family of Abraham and then the people of Israel where they keep looking around. You know, God tells them, hey, you don't need a king. And if you have a king, here's how it's going to go. He's going to take your daughters as his wives. He's going to have a harem. He's going to tax you more than you need to. You don't need to do this.
Put tariffs on other countries.
And they're going to look around. We'll roll past that. They're going to look around at all the other nations, and they're going to see it's really good and pleasing to our eye that they all have kings and we don't have kings. And so it's this frequent, it's typological. It is saying this is the way things go out. So when you ask, why would God set them up to sin? That assumes that sin is naturally enticing. And my argument is, I don't think it is. I think it is a warped perception on our part because of, and Ed's already addressed this, the curse that is upon us, which is that, but it's not a curse that God goes, once again, that's an assumption that God's going, I want to make it harder for you not to
sin. Well, I think we tend to put curse, we think, if I had the ability to curse people, this is what I'd do.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, if you eat that piece of chocolate, I'm going to make, you know, you have warts on your nose.
Right, yeah.
We'd make it's not a natural consequence.
Right.
It's just what I'm going to make happen.
It's arbitrary.
Yeah, it's just arbitrary because that's what we do.
Yes, the curse of eating chocolate cake is I'm going to gain 5 pounds.
Or I'm going
to... That's the curse.
Because if I eat too much, I'm going to become a diabetic.
Or whatever. That's what I mean is that's the curse. No one is doing that to me.
No.
That is the nature. And so the curse...
I heard Brian Zahn say it this way. He said, sin is its own consequence.
That's right.
Right.
He's right.
That's right.
Because it's all baked in with it.
Yes. And the idea behind this, I think we get to, is when you say what all future generations get cursed, it is the nature of the consequence of sin, as you said, is once I have become infected with this thing, my kids are going to be infected with
it. Well, and I would say this to you. I'm just going to let the cat out. I don't believe in an original sin. Like, you come out of the womb and you can't help yourself. But I ain't ever seen anybody that couldn't, that did help stop from doing it.
That's right.
And I don't remember who it is. I used to know the quote of the person said that the best proof for original sin is becoming a parent. Because you have somebody you dearly love that you gave birth to, that you would protect with your life, that you watch do things that you couldn't imagine another human being doing.
Sure.
That's right. They do things for no reason.
Yeah.
For no reason except to disobey.
Well, and that'll get, we can address that in the final question. My point is more once, and this does seem to be picked up by when God gives his name to the people of Israel. This is the part none of us seem to want to ever deal with because it don't feel like Jesus to say, he goes, and I revisit the sins of one generation onto the next generation and the next generation and the next generation. And there's this feeling of one revisit must mean God goes, because I'm so mad about that, I'm going to make sure you get yours. And not just you, your kids and your grandkids. He's describing the natural consequence, and this is how I would describe the wrath of God, which is God goes, there is a protection I put around people from the effects of sin and evil. But there are times where, and all of us have had this happen, where I've got a sin in my life, and I think one day that's probably going to come out. One day I'm going to finally feel that. But for a while, I start going, maybe I'm getting away with it. Maybe that's never going to happen to me. And then there comes a point where the wrath of God, not God going, I'm going to get you. God goes, I turn you over to that. That's the way Romans 1 talks about it. I will turn you over to your sinful desires. And what Jason just quoted from Brian Zahn, you will finally feel the own consequence of sin. Mm-hmm. Sin has this ability to have delayed consequences.
Yeah.
And
some that never end.
Some that never
end. That's right.
We've talked to people as pastors for years now, and they go through a period of time in life where they just blow their life up in all different kinds of ways.
Yep.
Drugs, alcohol, abuse, all the things that you would imagine. And then they turn around and mm-hmm. they repent and they start to build a new life, which is wonderful and great. But some people carry around scars and broken relationships and consequences of mm-hmm. those actions that just never, ever get resolved.
Well, and there are, you know, one of the things in the addict community that people know that is that you can get totally free from whatever you're addicted to,
yes.
that thing, that substance, that behavior, whatever it is. But the other behaviors that were around you that are, it's not what you focus on as much. Lying and hiding is a big one.
Mm-hmm.
Breaking the habit of not telling the truth. I know addicts that have been sober for 30 years and they have to regularly go confess what I said wasn't exactly the truth because it comes out before you can stop it.
Yeah.
You start saying things you know you're not even thinking, and you just say things that aren't true, and you have to go back and say, hey, what I said, that's not exactly true.
You haven't worked through all the implications
no,
of your sin. This is the part.
It's why a lot of people don't get in the 12 steps. You're continually going back, doing mm-hmm. fearless moral inventory. Where am I at now? What's been uncovered that I have to continue to work through?
Yeah. And that's the nature of crucifying the flesh, as Paul will use that language eventually, which is there's this way that sin gets trapped up in my flesh. I tend to only know the surface level of that, which is I was doing X, Y, and Z. And like you just said, I was lying and hiding to cover it, but I haven't even thought about the lying and hiding. I've been thinking about, well, now I'm not doing this anymore. And then once I start going, oh man, there is this habit I have of lying and hiding anytime I think people might know too much. So now I address that, but what I don't realize is behind that is I have this vanity problem that I really care about what everyone thinks
That's
about
right.
me. Then I deal with that problem and I realize behind that was, oh, I've never really fully accepted the love of God into the core. You know what I'm saying? Like there are these ways that I have to over and over again.
And the truth is every human being does that. I think the gift of addiction is that you have one that the world won't let you get away with.
Yes.
And most of us, in addition, addicts also have the other stuff everybody else has, is I have stuff people do, just they're just too nice and they let me get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't call me on it. And so I let me get away with it. Mm-hmm. And I don't try to put it to death either.
And mm-hmm. so the way that works out to future generations, I mean, is once I get... And I can't remember who the theologian I heard talk about it. He talks about sin is both poison and that it corrupts me and it is deadly to me. It will eventually kill relationships, all this, and then it will spiritually kill me. And what we mean by that is not just go to hell. It will cut me off from the activity of God's spirit to me. There does come a point I become so spiritually dead that I can't even feel God trying to draw me back. So that's, it is poison. But it also, and they said this, it is also pollution. And what it means is it does somehow not just affect me. It cosmically gets into the fabric of everything in that now we live in a world, and this will be my answer to the original sin thing, is it's not that every, and I don't know, the truth is I just don't know, whether every baby comes out and goes, well, I'm a sinner, I'm ready to get going. Or do they exist in a world that has so much pollution of sin? That now, even on a subconscious baby level, start to believe lies if I don't make it happen for me, it ain't going to happen. My mommy ain't just going to give that to me, so I should snatch it from them. Mm-hmm. I should do this. I should try, and whatever that happens. And at what age does that happen and what time? There is this overall pollution that gets into the environment of my family life, our social life. It gets trapped up in our culture, and it gets trapped up in every culture has different, that's why every culture has different like predominant sins that kind of get mm-hmm. us, because we all eventually all kind of agree. This is, no one sits down and goes, you know, we should all be really greedy. Mm-hmm. We should all really be very lustful. But it just happens over right. time. And so when you ask about if the story isn't literal, does that mean that, what did they say, there is no original sin?
Yeah, does that mean there's no original sin and we're not born sinners?
Well, yeah, if there's not the proclivity in human beings to sin, it sure is hard to explain our world.
Right. Yeah.
That yes. means it becomes a harder explanation because I'm not guessing the questioner thinks they are the one that didn't. Mm-hmm. I'd have to find the person that thinks they are still clean.
Right.
That they haven't done anything. Every act of their life, they'd be happy to put on a screen and let everybody watch, and they could defend it as having been the right choice.
Mm-hmm. Well, the way I love, because once again, it's just, original sin is a term that we have come up with, humans. I mean, yeah. outside of the scriptures, now it's looking at the scriptures, and I want to say all of that. So are terms like total depravity and things like that. Are we just from birth totally depraved? We can't do anything good on our own. Hard to be able to know one way or the other. I still love Dallas Willard's quote on it, where someone asked him, do you believe in total depravity? He says, I believe in sufficient depravity, which is I am sufficiently depraved that it's enough of a problem.
There was something in, I'll start here. When you come out of the womb, you are fully dependent on yep. everything from everybody. And as children, you don't have any other choice but to just cry out when you need something.
Yep. That's right.
And so in that way, yeah, babies are fully dependent. Mm-hmm. And there comes a point, though, right, that it shifts and something happens in that cute little human being that says, if it's going to happen, I got to take it, get it,
yep.
make it happen myself.
Or that even if they don't think they have to, they want to.
They sure. want to. And part of that is what you said earlier is, I can't trust anybody but me. Mm-hmm. So there's something to be said for when Jesus says, now, if all y'all want to get in the kingdom, y'all got to be like little kids. Mm-hmm. I think there was something about that in what he was saying was, there is a state that you need to go back to of full trust, full dependency.
I do think that's what he means.
I think that's mm-hmm. what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that completely obliterates the original sin argument, but I do think it comes down to that trust piece that Ed was talking about that we see happen in the garden. I can't trust God. I'm going to make it my own. I'm going to take over.
I say this all the time for the last, it is my mantra for what mm-hmm. it is God wants us to trust Him.
Absolutely.
And ultimately, He wants us to be the kind of person He can trust. Mm-hmm. As Dallas said, yeah. He wants to get the place that we can do what we want.
Yes.
That He has developed us, not that He what He wants. Mm-hmm. Of course, it is what He wants.
It is.
Because we trust Him completely. That's right. Mm-hmm. But He wants us to trust Him, and He wants to know we are trustworthy. Mm-hmm. Because there are a whole bunch of us. I mean, as Dallas used to say, most of us know we couldn't be trusted to do whatever we wanted. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we're just honest, we know we couldn't. Bad things would happen.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. yeah. I want to say this about the curse side of what Nathan said, too, about God, because I always, those passages, he described it perfectly. The other side of God says, and when he describes himself, he inevitably says that about the third, fourth generation. But when he talks about blessing, he says to 1,000 generations.
Yeah.
And I would say that there are a lot of people, and I believe this is our country to a degree, that there are a lot of people that have lived faithful lives before a lot of people in this country that are no longer living faithful lives. They're still living in the blessings of past generations, that God is living that out. You have great things happening to you, not because you are doing the right things, but because I know that was true for me for a long time. The more I look into my past and the heritage of my family, I lived in the blessing of other people for a long, long, long time. Yes. And the more I allowed the promises of God and the law of God to begin to surround me and correct me and help me to die to myself, a lot of the faithfulness that I had lived for years began to play off in my life. And hopefully I get in the line of blessing that some of my blessing will go to future generations as well. So there are indeed curses that happen. Mm-hmm. But then there is an air of purification that happens around the kingdom of God that also, it is the goodness of our God that his curses last for a while, his blessings last. He is just that good.
Yeah. And I think that's where I would get to, even with these questions of original sin and those kind of things, is original sin, total depravity, these kind of things, they have to carry a lot of weight for theological systems that depend on them to, well, I don't want to get into what that depends on, but there are a lot of things that they're carrying that aren't answering the question you're trying to get to, which what I understand is if this is literal, this isn't literal, what does that say about me and my relationship with God? And my question is, I'm assuming you're not a baby who typed this question out.
Right.
The only reason to get to whether a baby has enough sin in it, which is the issue of original sin. Does the baby have enough sin in it that God's going to do something to that baby if that baby passes
away? And I don't know. People debate, do we really have free will? I know that's a big argument people have back and forth. I can't prove to you how we have free will. I don't know anybody that operates their life as if they don't.
Right, yeah. Right.
I mean, you chose to type that question.
Yes.
Or you didn't.
Or you thought you did.
You thought you... Everybody is parenting as if their kid has free will, and they have free will. And you're making contracts with other people like they have free will.
That's right.
It may not be that you do.
Well,
but everybody lives like we do.
And I think for the sake of whether this is the heart of your question or you were just trying to see what we thought about it, what original sin and total depravity are trying to get people to is the need they have for Jesus. If I'm totally depraved, I need the Spirit of God to bring me into the kingdom. If I have original sin, then even from the moment of my birth, I need Jesus to save me. All of those things, regardless of whether I agree with original sin or the full doctrine of total depravity, what I would say is, yes, you need the Spirit of God to call you to repentance, and yes, you need Jesus to save you from your sins. And so that's where I get to on whether it's literal or not. The thing that Ed just ended us on with about the blessings of God, that should be enough to draw me towards the kingdom, which is regardless of when did my first sin occur? Or did that sin fully saturate my being and make me, totally depraved? The real question I should be asking is Jesus beautiful enough that he would be a reason enough for me to follow him? Is the kingdom and the blessings of the kingdom good enough that it'd be worth anything I'd have to get up to follow him? And if the answer of that is yes, then go after that and in whatever you believe literally or not literally about the Garden of Eden or when sin first occurs and all of that, I don't know if that affects whether or not you walk into the kingdom or not. Mm.
Well, our clock is running low. So
there we go.
I'm going to cut it off right there. We could probably just keep dieseling on this for a long time. So hope that cleared some things up for you, whoever asked this question. Thanks for that. You gave us a lot to talk about. Next week, come on back, we are going to tackle a question someone wrote to us about baptism. Fun topic. We'll get into that next week. See you then.
Bye.